702. Let's walk the talk.
Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
Professor Jeff Perez is my guest, author of The House of Paulo and professor at the University of Fort Hare. Prof, thank you once again for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
No, thank you. You seem to have learned something from me.
Prof, I learned so much from our last conversation. Trust me, so much from our last conversation. And what it has done is that it's edified me. It's made me approach the conversations about the various peoples of our country with a lot more confidence, because I'm beginning to understand how to separate the various concepts. Let me start, in fact, by asking this question, as raised by a listener who's listening to me now. It says, Aubrey, you have an aversion to using the word tribe when you speak of the various tribes of our country. And he's right, because I do have a bit of an aversion to using that name. Prof, I'm hoping that you'll be able to help me articulate why that word, tribe, tends to be a little bit difficult to use, particularly in the context of the Xhosa people.
In fact, a word is just a bunch of syllables, just a sound, or it's a bunch of letters on paper. It depends on how the word is used,
yes,
as to whether it's offensive or not. So, for example, the word Ubuntu, which actually is a very nice word as a word, because it was abused by the apartheid regime. Also, the word native, another word that, nothing wrong with the word as such, but the word was abused for oppression and exploitation.
Yeah.
So those words are not acceptable. The swastika, for example, which became a symbol of Nazi Germany, it's actually a very old Indian symbol,
yes,
from South Asia.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with it, but once it's abused, you cannot say, oh, the word is fine, because the word is now abused. And it's same with the word tribe, because in fact, it was quite a long time ago that scholars or politicians began to use the example of Belgium, you know, the country Belgium,
yes,
best known for Lukaku and some other things, because in Belgium, you find two different language groups or ethnic groups.
Yes.
You find the Flemings, and you find the Francophones or the Wallons. But you don't call them tribes.
Yes.
Yeah, you find another way to express the idea. You have let me not upset people. You have on the island of Britain, You have the people who regard themselves as Scots, people who regard themselves as English, people who regard themselves as Welsh. But you would never talk about the English tribe or the Scottish tribe.
Yeah.
And yet those very people who would never use the word tribe for themselves, now when they overwhelm Africa in the scramble for Africa, now they don't want to give the African people the dignity of nationhood, so that they call them tribes, and that is why the term is regarded as offensive. Yes, it's in many old books, and maybe people don't mean harm, but because it was used in the time of imperialism, colonialism, it acquired a negative aspect. However, it becomes quite difficult, a practical problem, to know how to replace the word tribe. Because the one thing which that word combines is a sense of politics and a sense of family and family relations.
Mm.
So the word that is most difficult to translate into English in the Xhosa language is the word isizwe.
Mm-hmm.
Because the English word tribe, or the Afrikaans word folk, is qu- quite close to Isizwe. But how do you translate it?
I usually translate it
as nation.
Yes.
But on the other hand, the English word nation implies, some mega country
Political
example,
structure, yeah, sure.
A political structure.
Yeah.
Whereas the word Isizwe in Xhosa, it could mean a political entity, such as AmaXhosa or AmaZulu or AmaMpondo or whatever.
Yeah.
But it could also mean a family unit. So, for example, you have got people who, in terms of who they relate to, who they marry and who they don't marry, they are, for example, I think I used the example, AmaKhudulu.
Mm.
Now, that is a one of the different clans. It's a family unit. It's not a political unit. And that's another word that often causes a lot of trouble to analysts, is the word clan, which is actually a word that was used to describe Scotland in the old days. So what academics tend to do is when they are talking about the political entity, they use the word nation or chiefdom. And when they're talking about the family entity, they use the word clan. But actually, the Xhosa word is the same for both.
Mm.
So we don't use tribe. It has too many bad associations. As soon as a person use that word, we are entitled to suspect him of imperialism or racism or whatever.
Or maybe even tribalism.
Well, I think there's another word that has now crept in, and that is the word ethnicity.
Yes.
So when we talk about tribalism, you're right. We never say tribalism in terms of somebody who is loving and patriotic towards his home people. Whenever we use the word tribalism, we mean it in a bad sense.
Yeah. So, yeah. I imagine, Prof, that part of what we are going to have to become accustomed to as we speak about the subjects that we do speak about, as we speak about the various families, nations, clans of our country and our continent, is perhaps as a preamble, be able to say that these are sensitive matters in terms of the various terminologies and their origins, their etymology. We will take you in the first instance for what you mean. So we'll do everything we can to try and understand you for what you mean, rather than come at you and try to finish you if you use a certain word that might not be informed by certain concepts that require a little more knowledge and a little more sensitivity and a little more understanding. We will take you for what you mean rather than for always what you say, because a lot of people still use the term tribe. And for the longest of time, I've intuitively not been happy to use that word. But I'm glad that you've been able to clarify for us perhaps what the reasons are for the aversion. And so to the person that wrote to me to say that I seem to have an aversion, it is correct. But I hope that you'll take what Professor Perry's as the reason why for my aversions as the reason that I closely associate with. Let's go into the language isiXhosa, which is spoken by a number of Isizwe. Right?
Aubrey, I was listening to your intro and I was going to give you 100%. Unfortunately, like most professors, you come to a point, you say, oh, no, that's not 100, that's 90.
Yes.
And I think on the language issue, that I had to mark you down. Can I just explain something?
Sure, please. Before you explain it, let me tell you where it's coming from. Vuyisile Mbiyake on Twitter says, I am Impondo from Bizana and I teach isiXhosa. We have isiMpondo that we speak a mixture of isiXhosa and isiZulu. And I think that's where your correction is going to be going to take me, please, Prof.
Yes, I think that correspondent just hit it right on the nail on the head. Let me explain. In fact, where I would criticize your friend there is isiMpondo is not a combination of Xhosa and Zulu. It is isiMpondo. The question now is where does a language begin and where does a language end? Now, what happened in South Africa is that you had two groups because it was the missionaries of the Christian Church who first reduced African languages into a written form. And they all started from Cape Town. And the one group of missionaries, mainly Presbyterians from Scotland, now the Harbour Church, they arrived at the town of Alice, where Fort Hare now is, and they wrote down the way that people spoke in Alice. And another bunch of missionaries, mainly Lutherans, that is Germans and Norwegians, they also left from Cape Town, but they got on a ship, and they arrived at Port Natal, the old name for Durban.
Yes.
They got off the ship and they start learning the language of the people, and they wrote down what they heard there, and they eventually came to call that isiZulu.
Yes.
And then after that, because in those days the normal English publishers and newspapers didn't have capacity to deal with African languages. The only the first Xhosa newspapers were actually produced at Lovedale Mission. So the dialect of Alice was written down in Alice, and then it was said, this is isiXhosa. And the other dialect was written down in what is now KZN, and they said, this is isiZulu. And then everybody who came to school, and was only the missionaries running schools in those days, were learned, you must talk like this. When they composed the grammars, then people were told how to talk. And if you tried to talk the language that you learned at home, then you saw, no, you're making a big mistake.
Yes.
You're not supposed to talk that way. And in fact, this is not something that is unique to South Africa. So, for example, in Britain, I'm subject to being corrected here, it was the dialect of Oxford in the south of England, the southern part of England, that became accepted as English. And then people from places in the north, places like Newcastle and Liverpool, when they try to speak the way they spoke at home, they say, no, you don't speak like that. That is not a proper language. So what actually happened, and what I think your correspondent is correctly upset about, is they are in Bizana. People want to speak and read and write as they learnt it at home. But the teacher needs to make sure that they pass the exams. Therefore, whatever they say is going to be a mistake. And yet the people who were brought up in Alice and the Monty Port Elizabeth side, Klebecha side, they don't have to worry about this because they just naturally speak like that. And it's even more complex, Aubrey, because there are languages which are not recognized at all.
Mm.
I mean, if you take Amashlubi, some of whom live in KZN, some of whom live in the Eastern Cape, some of whom live in the Free State, and now we're not even talking about those who live elsewhere. Their language, isiXhlubi, is much closer to Siswati, for example, than it is to isiZulu. But wherever they go, they are told that they're speaking wrongly. And I believe they're making an application to the Pan-South African Language Board for isiZulu to be recognized as a language.
It's interesting what you're saying there, Prof, because I had a conversation with somebody who speaks the language Afrikaans, for example, who said to me, you know, I hear people say that Afrikaans is Dutch. Mm. Afrikaans is not Dutch. Afrikaans is Afrikaans. and proceeded to explain, as you're making the example about the issue of standardization, about the who's in power at a particular time to be able to enforce the idea of correct this, incorrect this, versus what is spoken on the ground. And that's why you're beginning to see with the language Afrikaans that there are movements that are speaking of the issue of Cape Afrikaans. There's a name that they're giving it now. There's a name. My colleague Azania was having a great conversation about that. All of these are sort of varieties of that same language, but as spoken by the people, not necessarily as endorsed by the idea of standardized speech. So I think I hear exactly what you're saying, Prof, that we need to at some point accept the fact that there are languages spoken by the people. And then there are the languages that are enforced by officialdom.
But Aubrey, there are also the languages that people use to communicate with each other. Because if everybody just spoke their own language, then all languages would be secondhand. The way out, really, is to that everybody should have as a second language, a language that is spoken by nobody specifically.
Yeah.
So the best-known example of that is Swahili, which is spoken all over East Africa. But it's not. It's a language that has got a lot of Arabic words in it.
Yes.
Because of the contacts over the Indian Ocean, but it doesn't belong to any specific ethnic group. Another example, which is not quite that well known, is the language of Kinshasa in the DRC, which is called Lingala.
Yes.
And people speak it because it doesn't belong to anybody in particular. I think the problem with the example that you gave concerning Cape Town, I think, is quite similar to another issue which has developed in Johannesburg. Now, in Johannesburg, I think it's generally most people who are not from KZN nevertheless communicate in isiZulu as a second language.
Yes.
And that makes some tribalists jealous or think it's wrong. So there have actually been serious proposals that what they sometimes call tzotzital should be.
But
that tzotzital should not just be a slang.
Yes.
But that should be kind of codified and reduced to grammar and taught in schools, because it doesn't belong to anybody.
Yeah, no.
But I'm not a language theorist.
Yeah.
There was a very, very great and brilliant intellectual in from Cape Town. Actually, I think he was born in the East in Craddock, but generally associated with Cape Town, named Neville Alexander, who was a Robben Island prisoner. And he had many theories or arguments about bringing a completely new language aboard. But unfortunately, you better get someone that.
Knows
more about this.
I'm aware of that conversation, and I'm a big supporter of the idea that tzotzital is probably a great unifier in South Africa. I speak a little bit of Tsotsitaal, or a particular variety of Tsotsitaal that comes from the Pretoria side of Tsotsitaal, which has a particular age, I suppose. Tsotsitaal evolved so quickly.
But Aubrey, but then somebody will say something like, yes, but your Tsotsitaal is now tribalistic and
precisely.
You speak the Johannesburg.
Anyway, so Martin Coleman reminds me that the Afrikaans variety that I was talking about coming from Cape Town is called Afrikaaps. And there's a very strong movement, of course, that is a proponent of that Afrikaans, that variety of Afrikaans versus the standard Afrikaans. But there's another type of Afrikaans that's spoken up here in Gauteng that is probably slightly different to that. Anyway, it all goes through. The point, though, and I want to bring it back to the isiXhosa situation, is that it seems as though that the language isiXhosa has far greater reach than the nation amaXhosa. Would that be fair to say?
As you probably know, we are demarcated into 9 provinces that weren't there before.
Yes.
And those demarcations really did not begin in 1994. They started to begin even before 1910, where there was a border put between the old Cape Colony and the old Natal Colony, for example. And then everybody on the Cape side was taught Xhosa, and everybody on the Natal side, KZN side, was taught isiZulu, although there were a majority of people on both sides spoke neither isiXhosa or isiZulu. But when you get to a big city and you start to live in a big city, these distinctions cease to be as important as they used to be.
Yeah.
And then the whole question of orthography or spelling and the impact that has. So, for example, with Sesotho, the Sesotho in Lesotho and the Sesotho in South Africa is written in different ways.
Yes.
And in terms of Tsonga, there's a very strong argument that it's not a language. It's a language that was it's not a language of the people at all. It's a language that was basically composed and codified by the Swiss missionaries. But people speak it because what is the point in talking? And you can't make yourself understood. So people have to compromise. And although on the one hand, it's a very lovely and great thing that people love their heritage so much, but then you can get out of hand. There are many countries where people were forced to speak other languages, and I think Germany was one of them. I speak under correction. When Germany was divided, Germany and Europe, into hundreds of little states, then the move that all Germanic people should come together in one big country that was championed by a statesman like Bismarck, that was almost certainly, historically speaking, a good and inevitable thing. But then those same tendencies spilled over into what became Nazism. And I'm only using that as an example. Similar things happen in many countries, that what starts off as a great and wonderful consciousness of one's heritage, it becomes something that is then espoused by populace.
Mm.
And this is why, frankly, I'm rather nervous about the idea, which has many supporters in South Africa, that everybody, and in fact, this is something that is implemented now at the University of KZN, is that everybody you know, all kind of, especially minorities, must be able to have some knowledge of isiZulu.
Yeah.
You know, which in itself sounds okay, but I would have preferred, not that anybody asked me, that everybody who attends University of KZN should have be thoroughly familiar with an African language. Because if you're going to say that everybody in at Institutes of Higher Education in KZN must speak Zulu, then everybody at Institutes of Higher Education in the Eastern Cape must speak Xhosa. Everybody, yes, Institutions of Higher Education in Northwest must speak Setswana. Everybody at Free State must speak Sesotho. I mean, are you not then going back to Bantustans? Are you not then? So although I totally agree that African languages must be brought forward, I'm very, very nervous about the potential that could go wrong.
The nationalism that can arise out of that. Yeah.
No. Yeah, I mean, for example, if you are a Xhosa speaker or a Sotho speaker at KZN, must you now learn to speak Zulu?
Yeah.
Or if you are a Zulu speaker in the Eastern Cape, must you learn to speak Xhosa?
Yeah. It raises all sorts of practical issues. I understand, Prof.
Yeah, but also issues of political principle. Frankly,
yeah.
I mean, I can understand where the impulse comes from.
Yeah.
And I think it's a good impulse, but at the end of the day, it would only be Gauteng that would be a multilingual culture, and I don't think that would help South Africa. Yeah. To,
maybe we should look to Whanganui, you know.
There have been people who have argued that Whanganui could have developed into a wonderful language.
Yeah,
but it consists entirely of what I think linguists call the imperative mood. Go there. Do this.
Yeah.
Pick, you know, walk, run.
Yeah, but I mean, wouldn't the argument be then, let's develop it then? Let's develop it so that it isn't just about the imperative mood, that it has greater dimension, greater texture to it, greater... whenever I hear the argument that says because the language has just or consists only of the imperative mood, again, I then say... But then that's the limiting of ourselves. Let's develop it. Afrikaans at some point was said to be a creolized sort of slave language that contained the imperative mood. But somebody had the political will to develop it. Of course, there are questionable issues around how that happened, who it benefited, and all of those issues. But here we have a language used in science, in philosophy, and that was developed.
Well, you know, the thing is that, again, I think that Neville Alexander had some, good ideas on this subject, which did not include Whanganui. But I'm really, really not competent.
Yeah. No,
I think my point is that whereas language can be a very unifying factor, it can add to social cohesion.
Yes.
But it can also be very, very divisive.
For sure.
And also, you cannot force people. I mean, there have been some, and there have been, and there still are, some determined efforts to revive the old Khoisan languages.
Yes.
The vocabulary of which and the grammar and the structure of which are known. And they are still somewhere in the rift itself. Speakers, but and I've seen proponents of this very nice idea, walking along with little kind of vocabulary books, trying to remember words that don't come to them naturally. It's a difficult thing.
Sure. No, I understand that
we have problems in this country.
Sure. I understand that you're concerned about the contrived nature of it. It seems way too choreographed. I want to go back to isiXhosa, Prof.
Please.
Given the fact that amaXhosa proper themselves.
Yes.
enjoy the fact that enjoy the use of their language, particularly in the area of the Eastern Cape. And I mean, it's ubiquitous. It's right up to here in Gauteng, even to the most far-flung parts of Zimbabwe. IsiXhosa has a very strong presence. Why is that?
I think, I'm not sure that it is. The IsiXhosa that is spoken in Johannesburg, for example, has quite a number of Zulu words
yes.
that have been assimilated into it. Words like Gijima.
Yes.
For
Baleka.
For Baleka or Kuluma.
For
Teta. And I don't think it's something exclusive. I mean, if you wanted to define the Amakosa nation as opposed to their neighbors, which are the Tembu nation or the Koleka nation, or the Pono nation, and there are smaller groups like Amabomvana, and then there are those who in distant past came from KZN, like the Amabele, Amashlubi, Amazizi, Amatoro. They don't think of the nation as being somehow dominant over them. I think although there is a convention that everybody who is a Xhosa is to somewhere along the line descended from a great hero named a Xhosa, it's like Xhosa is, my opinion, it's like Adam. No one can trace, maybe there was such a person, but it's doubtful when you trace your descent. You never go that far back. I mean, in fact, we can define Amakosa or the Xhosa Nation as the people who accept the chieftainship of the Chawe clan, just as we can define Amampondo as people who accept the kingship or chieftainship of the Faku Nyawuza clan. Mm. Tembu are people who accept the chieftainship of the Amadomo. And yet there are people within those nations who you can show clearly there are five or six Xhosa clans that are clearly of Khoisan origin.
Yes.
There are Tembu clans that are clearly of Sesotho origin. So these units, such as the Xhosa and Tembu and so on, in Tembu land, in Kanduri district, there are two clans, the Abelungu and the Amamolo, who are descended on the one hand from white people, on the other hand from Indian people, shipwreck victims, because these were open societies. You joined a clan. So you were born into a clan, but you then join, that's your family. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
But you are now accept the kingship or the royalty of one clan among yourselves.
I'm always intrigued by the reality of the organic shaping of different izizwe. I'm using that word because I can't find the English. I don't like that word. But the
nation.
I'm intrigued by the fact that different izizwe are created by so many reasons. Yeah, so many different reasons, and sometimes we want to impose our very simplistic reasons why certain izizwe exists. So, I mean, you've just explained now that there were shipwrecks where people who are Indian, people who are white, who then assimilated and became part of the Xhosa Izizwes of that time. And over time, they have now become a natural part of AmaXhosa. People who are of Khoisan descent, who are part of AmaXhosa. The cosmopolitan nature of the various Izizwes that we have is sometimes underplayed, Professor Jeff Perez.
Yes, but here again, I don't think you realize quite how many academic toes you've just stepped on. and I must say that my views are unpopular.
Yeah.
Among
welcome
my
to
colleagues.
The club. Welcome to the club.
So if I can just explain what the argument is about without having to justify myself. Yep. I feel that the origin of chiefship is the family unit, people who all grew up together. And then with the passage of generations, they look up to the senior, well, it was male, but let's not get into gender, the senior person. They all look up to the father or the grandfather or the great-grandfather until you get to a point where the grandfather is so far back in time that you cannot trace exactly how you belong. So I would say the origin of clans, of chiefship, is the head of the family. And then over time, certain things happen whereby certain clans or certain families achieved dominance over all others, you see?
Yeah.
Now, and it's especially prominent in certain districts.
Yes.
So, for example, in the Xhosa area, all the chiefs, almost without exception, are members of the Chawe clan.
Yes.
But in Tembuland, for example, especially in a district like Kanduli, you have got people who regard themselves as Tembu, but they're chiefs, like the Holomisa family, for example.
Yes.
The Holomisas are Tembus, but the Holomisa family are what they call Hegebe, Ama Hegebe, and they are not related. And then you have the Ekwatis, very, very numerous among the Tembu. They're also not members, the Kamela, Kina, Walter Subu's people. Those are all Tembus, but they have their own chiefs from their own families.
Right.
Because the Madiba clan, same thing in Bizana. Almost all the chiefs in Bizana accept the Faku line as the royal clan, but they themselves are not Faku.
Mm.
Now, the other people, of course, they are, you know, stubborn and stupid, in my opinion. Don't see it like that. They think you can change your clan like you can change your socks. They think that, you know, identities are fluid and made up and so on. But I feel that the basic social unit the coastal strip, whether Zulu or Xhosa or whatever, is the family. And then from the family, chieftainship derived. And then from historical processes over a long period of time, certain royal families emerged and others were not recognized as royal family.
Yeah, yeah.
But as I said, I'm a minority in this.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, if you want to look at the Khoi history, or Khoi really is the better explanation,
yes.
If anybody could identify the head of the Sukwini clan, which is very, very numerous in the western part of the Eastern Cape, if anybody could identify the head of that particular Xhosa clan, they would have identified the last great king of all the Khoi people in the whole South Africa, but they subordinated themselves in the 18th century. Their last great queen, Hoho, there are mountains close to Konle, Dimbaza, which are the mountains of Hoho, and that's all that remains of their kingship.
Did the Khoi people, did they have the same sort of political structures that you would perhaps find. I watch how different groups, and sometimes it feels like it's for political expedience, are arising, and they arise very recently. They've just sort of been spawned by the circumstances of the day, have arisen. Would they have had the same political structures of kings and courts that you see perhaps amongst the Zulu, the Xhosa themselves, or are we talking about different types of structures where there is a head of a family rather than ukumkani, as it were?
Oh, well, now I'm going to make myself even more unpopular, so I hope the program is nearly at an end.
We've got 2 minutes.
According to great experts, namely me, all the Khoi people, their original political structures were based on locality. So you will read in Van Riebeck's diary, of which all the most of the people that you've just been referring to have all got copies of Van Riebeck's diary. You have people like the Hesekwa and the Inkwa and the Atakwa and many others, Hundikwa. Kwa is a suffix. It's like Ama Kosa.
Yes.
Then they say Gona Kwa.
Yes. Yes.
It means people of.
Oh, yes.
And they basically had something which I could compare to places in the South Pacific, like Fiji and Tonga and those kinds of places, what they call a big man system.
Yes.
In other words, they did have chiefs. They did have they did have councils. They did have assemblies and meetings. The thing is, they didn't have permanent structures.
Yes.
So everybody came to a meeting, but if this person didn't like to agree with what was being said in the meeting, he simply moved across a mountain with his followers, and they created their own.
Yeah, because they were very, very nomadic, I imagine, yeah?
It wasn't so much they were like nomadic. It's much more because land, the party believed today, was like a free good,
yes.
like air and water.
Yeah.
It was more people that you got on with and people, you know, whose company you enjoyed. And if you didn't, the thing is that the heredity factor, the institution of chiefship is very much criticized as being undemocratic.
Yes.
Which creates a stability and a consistency and a sort of a baseline within Prof. which politics, a center around which politics can operate. And yes, thank you all.
I'm going to stop the conversation so that you don't get more and more unpopular, but also because we've run out of time. I really am looking forward to more conversations with you and some of the colleagues that you've directed us to talk about some of the various izizwe of South Africa. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank
Professor Jeff Perez, author of The House of Palo, and professor at the University of Fort Hare. It's